The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Well, many thanks for your interest in our project. We won't worry about it, no. We started the project on the promotion of human rights some time ago when I was in the Interamerican Commission on Human Rights, and the idea was at that time to create an experiential learning opportunity for the students to contribute to the development of human rights norms and to learn about the process and so forth. That was the official reason for it. When I was elected in the Committee Against Torture, I felt so guilty that I couldn't be here, and I thought I need to do something for the students as well. And then under that project, we take a number of students to Geneva, together with Jennifer De Laurentiis, who's a lawyer, a graduate from the law school, and always one or two faculty members. This year, Darren Hutchinson and Jeremy Rath. And then the students perform different functions. That's the official reason. The real reason is that, and I will not repeat it publicly, that thanks to the superb work done by our team, I am the best prepared member of the Committee Against Torture ever, and that gives me a competitive advantage that I don't mind to confess to you. The students that can go, really committed and enthusiastic. You know, knowledge is not an abstract thing. Motivation is very important. We learn in a different way when we have passion with the topic, and we have been always fortunate to have people who saw this not just as an intellectual challenge, which it is, but also, you know, there was a special relationship with the subject matter. So, we're here in typical experiential learning mode to hear from them and to see how was their experience and so forth and so on. They have been instructed only to talk about the good things, so I hope they will comply with that, and we will move ahead. I have two news to share with you. One is that we got a donor, Mr. Peter Kovlek, to contribute more resources to this program. And the good news is that instead of 6 students, we're going to take 10 students next year. The Kovlek Foundation is notorious for its support to human rights issues, and in particular issues involving the fight against torture. So I'm very pleased, and I will say this. We charmed Mr. Kovlek when we invited him to the presentation done by the students he accompanied us last year. And who knows, they wanted to have some other people and this research. But because I repeat one thing about this program, that we had how many applicants? 60 applicants we had last year. I repeat that we cannot take 60 people. No, because the idea in the institution and our personal, my personal commitment is to open up opportunities for them. Unfortunately, we have to select a group because of the resource issue. The good news is that this year is going to be 10 instead of 6. So I'm very pleased to share with you that. Let me finish my remarks by thanking Jennifer De Laurentiis, who is here to my left, and coordinate this project. She's a lawyer, a graduate from the institution, and has a superb knowledge and a tremendous organizational skills. So thank you again, Jennifer. I also want to thank my esteemed colleague, Darren Hutchinson, for accompanying us. I invite, as I said, from time to time, one or two faculty members. The idea is to get the insights also for the purposes of contributing further to this important goal of a world without torture, and our colleagues have theoretical insights, administrative insights that are very important to pursue and pursue that goal. I thank you also for your interest. Let me also thank Amalia, Gillian, Anna, Alexandra, Jay, and Solomon for the work they did when we were there. An extra advantage for me is to get to know more each of you, the administrative pressures of being a dean of an institution. Unfortunately, it doesn't give me time to know more about the students. You have to balance many things. And then for me, it's not only a source of advice and knowledge to the students, but it's a possibility to know more about the students. Well, thank you again, and Jennifer, let us
Good afternoon, everyone. The United Nations Committee Against Torture project is really a unique experiential learning opportunity created by Dean Grossman following his election to the committee in 2003. Since 2003, he has served as the committee's vice chair up until last spring when he was elected the committee's chair. Following his initial election in 2003, the dean quickly found a way to open up this opportunity for students by creating the UNCAP project in 2004. And as was mentioned, I assist the dean as the UNCAP project coordinator, and I'd like to share some nuts and bolts about the project with you. The project takes place every fall semester, and through a variety of different components, it enables the students to enhance their knowledge about the prohibition of torture and ill treatment under international law, as well as about the Committee Against Torture in particular. There's a seminar that takes place each fall. The students take the seminar for credit, and it's co-taught by the dean and myself. And it includes specialized readings, instructions, and discussions about the prohibition of torture and other ill treatment. There's also extensive research and review of related jurisprudence, state party reports to the committee, State Department of Country reports, NGO shadow reports, and other relevant information released by the committee itself. I should note here that the participants are covered by confidentiality agreements through which we are able to access certain meetings as well as materials. Each student is assigned one or two of the state parties that is scheduled to appear before the committee in November. And they review and synthesize a tremendous volume of information and human rights reports about their particular countries. They also conduct supplemental research, and based on their findings, they create an extensive list of issues which pertains to their country's compliance or lack thereof with the convention obligations. These detailed lists of issues examine compliance or lack thereof article by article. The papers are a key aspect of the project because they help inform the questions that the dean will ask of state party delegations while we are at the session in Geneva. The project also includes a unique field component. For 1 week in November, we all accompany the dean to the session. And this last November, we had the good fortune of being accompanied by two WCL faculty, Professor Hutchinson, as well as Jamin Raskin. And I should say that their presence added great value to the project. We had a lot of opportunities for some very interesting and engaging discussions about the prohibition of torture, as well as how that interfaces with other aspects of the law. Attending the committee session is, needless to say, a pretty eye-opening experience. It offers rare insight into the universal human rights system, into the UN, and into the committee itself. While in Geneva, we meet frequently over meals to discuss and respond to unfolding events, and we also somehow managed to squeeze in a few site visits to, for example, international organizations. And we have a dinner with WCL alumni, other committee members, and human rights advocates. It's a great opportunity for the students to make and cultivate contacts in the field. Turning to the upcoming session in November, there's a diverse group of countries that are scheduled to appear before the committee. They are Azerbaijan, Colombia, El Salvador, Moldova, Slovakia, Spain, and Yemen. In terms of participation in the UNCAP project itself, it's open to WCL JD students, and applications consisting of a one-page cover letter and CV will be accepted beginning this Thursday, February 12th, through Tuesday, March 3rd. And they can be emailed directly to me at jdelaurentis.wcl.american.edu. There will also be announcements posted in the docket under the Office of the Dean as well as on the UNCAT project webpage. You can also feel free to send me an email or to telephone me. My extension is 4071. In closing, I'd like to thank Dean Grossman as well as Professor Hutchinson and a great group of students this year. They were very dedicated and made tremendous contributions to the project. I'd like to now turn the mic over to Professor Hutchinson.
Thank you, Jennifer. I have to go first because there's a very important faculty meeting going on right now that I left to come and talk to you about gladly, but I have to go back to the meeting because I promised that I would. I just want to say that this has been a terrific opportunity, not only for me as a professor and a scholar, but also just to become a part of a broader community of people dealing with human dignity around the world. And I encourage you, some of you may be on the fence in terms of thinking of applying. Some of you already know that you want to do so. I would strongly encourage you to apply to participate in the program. Having said that, this year's group was really strong. They were heavily prepared and just offered a lot of great insight. So you have a tough act to follow, but that should incentivize you to work really well. When Dean Grossman asked me to participate, he billed it as a way for me to do some of my work that I already do on issues of racial discrimination, sexual orientation, and constitutional law in a human rights context. And there is a lot of work being done domestically in terms of trying to use human rights and international norms to frame constitutional law arguments. There's a big debate on that here at the law school a few years ago. And also, historically, and I see some of my students from Law and Social Change in here, historically, domestic civil rights advocates have often turned to human rights law and human rights norms as a way of advocating change within the United States. So it was a perfect opportunity for me to explore some of those historical roots and also to think about how we can use those same arguments today to influence change not only here in the United States but abroad. I'd like to deliver one comment that my colleague Jamie Raskin made. He and I were remarking while we were there that this is an amazing opportunity for students. It's not something that we certainly could do when we were in law school. The weekend before this particular event, I was at a conference at Emory University, and there are a few law professors who were, in fact, flying to Geneva to participate themselves, and I told them I was going to meet Dean Grossman and several students there, and they were shocked that we could bring students to participate in the program. So it is a unique opportunity. It's one that will enrich your studies here and hopefully inform your careers after you leave WCL. So with that, I will turn it over. I wish I could stay and answer questions that you might have, but feel free to email or come by my office if you want to talk about the program more. I'm sure the students will give you a closer perspective on the issue as a student, but I would happily talk to any of you if you have any questions. So apologies for walking out. Dean Grossman, are you coming? Or are you just gonna, you have to say, all right. Well,
it's not a bird.
He will hold the bag.
Will you excuse me?
Yes. I will let them know.
Thank you, Professor. And on behalf of the students that are part of this year's UCAT project, welcome. It's great to see so many people here, so many people committed to eradicating torture. What the students are going to try to do is talk about all the different components from our perspective. As the dean and Jennifer alluded to, there's a lot that goes into this and a lot of really cool experiences. And I think before we get into some of the details, we're going to let Solomon speak first on how, from a student's perspective, this kind of fits into a big picture. So Solomon has done a ton of research prior to this project and during this project on different areas of human rights law. So we all kind of look to him as the guru of the group. So we're going to let him give kind of a big picture view.
I didn't know you looked at me like that. I'm glad.
Never face.
That's
okay.
I was not in it. I wanted to provide just a very basic picture of the legal character of the committee and how that fits into the greater scheme of human rights protections and international law in general. The convention, of course, is a treaty, and it functions as law in the same way as a contract does, because all of the parties agree to be bound by the provisions. Article 17 of the convention creates a committee of experts, which then becomes the Committee Against Torture. They're nominated by the state parties, and they're charged with monitoring compliance and, I guess, promoting compliance, among other things, with the convention. Article 19 of the convention requires state parties to report on their own compliance with the convention. They're supposed to do this within a year of ratification and every 4 years thereafter. I think in practice that gets a little bit mixed up just due to sort of practical realities of how much work the committee can actually do and how forthcoming states are, but that's sort of the ideal structure. So what we do in helping the dean prepare is look at the reports that have been submitted by state parties sort of talk about maybe where there are holes, where there's room for improvement and things like that. But ultimately, the purpose is to engender a dialogue between the committee members and the state party on how things are going with respect to compliance with the convention. That dialogue centers, of course, the focal point of that dialogue is the session where representatives of the state party come and are questioned by the committee members, and there's some back and forth and room for dialogue and things, but the result is a group of conclusions and recommendations published by the committee. Andy's going to talk more about that later, but this I think is really the crux of how the committee's work fits into the scheme of international law and human rights protections, and I think it does so in three ways. The conclusions and recommendations elaborate on the content of the treaty obligations, and they provide notice to states on what it means not to torture, what it means to refrain from cruel and inhumane treatment. So that becomes fleshed out, elaborated, and published so everyone knows what it means, and we're all talking about the same thing when we say torture. The publication of this information, to me, exerts a surprisingly strong influence on states. They're sensitive to the public exposure of what is essentially bad PR. And so I've always been surprised by the extent to which states will actually react to having their problems made public to the international community. So there is a coercive effect that these proceedings have on states and how they actually behave and form policies internally. Lastly, the conclusions and recommendations and other comments and decisions by the committee are incorporated into international law by international courts, human rights courts, things like that, regional courts, and also domestic courts, like U.S. district courts, which actually cite the decisions of the committee, the reports from the state party, and things like this. The work of the committee is really becoming more and more integrated into the overall fabric of human rights protections, and it's a very exciting thing to participate in because probably as a lot of you know, there are a lot of questions about the sort of effectiveness of international law, the effectiveness of UN organs and things like this, and this project provides an excellent opportunity to see how the how these proceedings do affect. It may not be grand, it may not be a decision from a district court in the U.S., but it does work its way into this overall scheme of international law and human rights protections. And then I will move now just to discuss briefly the work that we do during the sessions. Other people will discuss the work we do moving up to the sessions. But while at the sessions, it's sort of a working vacation. We do a lot of fun stuff. But we do work on the issues that arise based on the dialogue. So we make, you know, some changes to the work that we've done previously based on what's come up during the sessions. We have working lunches with the dean to discuss the proceedings. We sort of prepare further questions, often based on the NGO meetings, which are now a formal part of the committee's proceedings. So NGOs will come and say, well, the state party says this, but we say this. And so we have to sort of bring all the issues to the table and figure out what's going on for real. And then, as Anna will talk about later, we sort of take notes and prepare for looking at what the conclusions and recommendations are going to be following the closing session. But it's not overly intensive. Like, we're at the sessions all the time. I spent maybe one or two late nights and maybe an early morning, but it's not too bad. But there's work. And I think some of the more disciplined members of the group managed to, like, bring textbooks and read for class. Take that with a grain of salt. So I think with that, I'll turn it over to whoever's next.
I'm just going to talk very briefly about something to elaborate from a student's perspective, what Jennifer mentioned in her opening, which is the preparing of the supplemental list of issues. So as Jennifer mentioned and the dean alluded to, the conference that we're going to is where countries are appearing before the committee to defend or explain their compliance with their obligations under the convention. And our job as students is we're each assigned one or two countries and to basically research everything we can and prepare a memo for Jennifer and for the dean on our opinion on the country's compliance with their obligations under the convention. And then also a broken down by article of the convention, a list of questions that we think the country needs to be asked. And leading up to the conference, this really becomes what we spent hours and hours working on and is truly a one-of-a-kind experience, in my opinion, for a student at the school, because you're really placed in the medium position of reading all of these NGOs and having access to all of this information and then deciding for them what is the most important thing, what are the things that we really need to make sure this country responds to. And it's really a phenomenal feeling then to go to the sessions and watch Dean Grossman, his chair, ask these countries the questions that you wrote, the issues that you thought were important. And we were joking with Jennifer last week that when we were given, you know, the assignment and the explanation to do this, we thought it was a largely academic experience. Sure, we'll research the countries, we understand. But you end up playing an integral role. You end up providing a memo that becomes very, very important to what the country has to account for and to what Dean Grossman asked the delegates at the conference. So it's really cool. It is terrifying, actually, but it's really cool. So to give you an idea of the variety, I had two countries that I worked on, Kazakhstan and Montenegro. And if you Google Kazakhstan and human rights, you will get about probably 5 million hits. And so my experience with Kazakhstan was Amnesty International had written a long report on their compliance with the Convention Against Torture, so had Human Rights Watch, so had all these NGOs on the ground. I mean, it was just an overwhelming mountain of information that I needed to go through and decide what are the most important things that the committee needs to know. By contrast, nobody writes about Montenegro. Montenegro just got their independence in 2006. Human rights groups internationally that are concerned about the Balkans are justifiably looking at Kosovo and Serbia. So for Montenegro, there's really a lack of information. Even just trying to understand their domestic legal system, because it's brand new, was a whole new world of challenges. So I had both extremes. On the one hand, really just trying to filter information, and then on the other hand, just trying to find reputable sources of information. And I ended up, for example, finding a student human rights group in Montenegro that had documented several allegations of torture, and found myself in a really uncomfortable position where I couldn't confirm this information from any other source. All I had was the students group. And you're put in a situation where, what do you do about that? I mean, this is very real. This is not merely an academic exercise. And so, you know, I've included this in the memo and included, you know, that this isn't confirmed by anything else. And Dean Grossman read that memo and articulated questions based on the students group to the delegates from Montenegro. And they had to account for what these students were saying, which it's a pretty remarkable thing to be able to do. So it's, yeah, it's great. It's a very unique experience.
And in our defense, Solomon, we had Professor Rice, though. That's why we had a textbook with us. I'm going to speak a little bit about the seminar that occurs throughout the fall semester. And it meets pretty much every week. There are some weeks that we're given time to work independently on our countries, and you utilize that time as you need. But for the most part, you meet Wednesdays or time to be determined, I think, depending on the semester. And this seminar was really unique and exciting in a lot of ways, because for me personally, I hadn't had any experience with the Convention Against Torture or any other UN human rights body. My experience had been more the Inter-American system. So you arrive at the seminar with a binder of all the appropriate documents, and throughout the semester you walk through these documents and individual claims that are brought in front of the committee. And you're given the opportunity to sort of parse out what it means and how it all interrelates. And the interesting aspect of that is then you have the chair of the Committee Against Torture, and Jennifer, who is extremely knowledgeable and an expert on these issues, walking you through where you analyze things wrong, pretty much. And it's a really great opportunity to come to the table and say, okay, I looked at these documents in these cases, and this is where I think the committee is going or what they were thinking, and then have the dean say, well, actually, you know, this is where we started, and this is where we're trying to go, or, you know, this is where we're hoping to go with this, and to become aware of those nuances. So it's sort of a mini, you know, 3 years of law school on the U.S. system, on the UN system within a semester. And you start to realize that there are words or catchphrases, just like we have standard of review for the Supreme Court under the Equal Protection Clause. You know, there's those similar catchphrases that exist within the convention that you wouldn't pick up if you just had to look at this stuff on your own. And it's fascinating and phenomenal, and really gives you a different perspective on how to approach other conventions and other committees under the UN system if you were going to try to use that for any type of advocacy or human rights litigation that you would bring in your practice after law school. So I thought that was extremely valuable experience, and that's what the seminar meant.
I'm going to talk a little bit about what it's like to be there in the sessions and the CAT sessions, and I thought it was one of the most unique experiences I've had working in the area of human rights and immigrants' rights advocacy. Being there, I've done some direct services, and I'm sure a lot of you have, and working here in the U.S. and working with U.S. law, it's difficult to insert international human rights law, and CAT is actually a form of protection for people who face torture when they return to their country. It's one of the only international instruments that's really applicable in human rights here in the U.S. And so being in the sessions kind of opened my eyes to other forms of creative lawyering that that NGOs and advocates are doing around the world that can really be brought back here. And so the sessions are, in a way, everybody else here can add to it, but I saw it as a form of conversation between the UN, the UN commissioners, the representatives of the country, including Dean Grossman, and the country representatives, which are civil servants. They range from police commissioners to diplomats to prison guards sometimes, and these are people who come in and represent their countries and are answering the questions that the commissioners are presenting to them, and they provided a report to the commissioners, and the commissioners respond with questions, and so it's a back and forth in some ways, and there seems to be some level of informality as the questions are posed and the answers are given in the sessions. And the students, we sit and take notes, and and kind of form our own opinions about what's going on, and then at lunch we get to discuss with Dean Grossman and at dinner what our thoughts are, and then prepare maybe follow-up questions. But really at the sessions, it's I think we benefit the most just being there and taking note of what's going on. I worked on Kenya as one of my countries, and they had a huge delegation of NGOs present, and also a huge delegation of civil servants of the representatives of the country, and watching listening to the NGO groups go before the commission for me was just absolutely fascinating, because of the impact that they had at those hearings, and because of the very attentive audience that they had from the commissioners and the conversation that went back and forth there. I thought that was fascinating, and also, again, gave me ideas in terms of coming back here to the U.S. and doing more creative lawyering and realizing that there's so much out there that can be done besides just, you know, applying the law as we see it and as we're told to apply it. And so I thought that was a really great experience. And if anybody wants to ask me questions about the application process or the experience, my email is basically amalia.greenberg@gmail.com, so you're welcome to email me.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about the opportunities that we had outside of just the work that we did for the committee and during our sessions. And Dean Grossman opened by saying that it's a priority for him to open up opportunities for students, and I think that it was a theme through like every day and every event that we did that wasn't just being at the session. You could tell that Dean Grossman and Jennifer had put thought into how to open up opportunities for us to network and to meet people and to make contacts and to hear from people what it's like to work at different organizations in international law. And so I just really appreciated that aspect of the program as well. So I'm just going to talk about three of the particular things that we did. One was we visited the ICRC, which is the International Committee of the Red Cross, and we went on a tour of the Red Cross Museum, which some of you guys might have just seen, like the hooded people. Yeah, and the pictures of the children with the number plaques. Those are the children project is one of the things that they do, and they help reunite children who are open through war with other family members. So that was just sort of, we walked into this room and there were just like these pictures of children. It was a really powerful experience. And I mean, the whole museum was just really, really cool. But we also got to meet with one of the lawyers who works for the ICRC. And she gave us a presentation about the work that they do, which was really, really interesting. And she also talked about the possibilities of like jobs and internships, which is always a great, really, really great thing to have a firsthand contact with someone in an organization. So the other thing we did was there was, in addition to just the sort of lunches and dinners we had with Dean Grossman and Jennifer, we also had an opportunity to have a formal alumni dinner. And there were guests who were invited, which included people from international organizations, as well as diplomats, and then there were alumni from who were working abroad in Europe. So we had alumni from France, Spain, Switzerland, and probably other places. And that was really cool because it was sort of like a peer-to-peer networking where you could ask questions about what it's really like to work for different organizations and also to make those contacts that then you can use later to get your jobs and internships and stuff like that. So, and it was also just a really fun time. I mean, you know, you get to debate these things that we're all passionate about, human rights issues, and talk about our observations about the sessions and hear from other people about the type of work that's being done in other countries. So that was great. And then Amalia and I had a unique experience where we're both interested in labor issues. So the dean just on the spur of the moment set up a meeting for us with someone at the ILO. So we got to go and see the ILO building and meet a senior official from the ILO. And he told us about the work that they do and the structure of the organization. And we asked some questions about internships and jobs and questions that we had about different projects that the ILO has undertaken. So that was also really, really cool. So, I mean, I know it's been sort of said by other people, but I think that this type of opportunity is what makes this school special. And I feel really, really fortunate to have been a part of it. And at the same time, it's one of the reasons that I came to this school over other schools, because you don't get this opportunity, you know, no matter how fancy a school's name is, you know, you aren't going to get this type of opportunity there. So I encourage everyone to take advantage of this opportunity. And finally, I want to say that getting to know the professors who were on the trip was also really cool, because I'd never had either of them. And you know, we spent the alumni dinner talking to Professor Raskin about the death penalty in Maryland and slot machines and all these sort of political issues that were going on. And we talked to Professor Hutchinson about his courses and you know, just all of his interests are really fascinating. That was really, it was really, really great to have those other opportunities that were in addition to the work that we did in the sessions.
Okay, I think some people have 1 o'clock classes. I just, as you guys are leaving, to especially the one else in the audience, this was the second time I applied that I got in, so I think that goes for a bunch of us. So if you don't get in once, come back the next year. I'm going to talk about the conclusions and recommendations that we had to draft, but first I wanted to make some additions to the points that my classmates have made. One is that when we're doing the research for the supplemental list of issues, it's very interesting because the research that we're doing is not only about kind of torture as you imagine it, this kind of stereotypical view of, you know, the rack, that sort of thing. It's depending on the record of the country you're researching, this expands to lots and lots of different things. Arbitrary detention, domestic violence issues, police brutality. And so you're not just researching a narrow issue in a country. You are researching a broad range of issues and using your own kind of judgment and skills to try and tie those issues into the convention, which I think is really good training. Another thing to add on to what Amalia was saying about using the committee proceedings as kind of a way to dialogue between U.S. law and international law. I'm in the Human Rights Clinic right now, and we have cases in U.S. federal court, in U.S. immigration court, and in the Inter-American Commission. And frequently, we use law that has been made in the committee to make our point. And so the things that you're going to be doing, the reports that the countries submit, often are used in domestic courts or in other international enforceable bodies. So it really has an impact. And finally, before I get to the conclusions and recommendations, and I am running out of time, but I wanted to say about the form of advocacy we all get trained to do in law school, and that's working in an adversarial system. And this project was really eye-opening for me. I mean, it seems silly, but to be in a different system, it is, you know, in the international human rights kind of universe, there's much more than just this adversarial one-off, one person versus another person or a person versus the state. These sessions were part of kind of a long-term project, kind of a long-term vision by the committee to try and make the countries comply with the Committee Against Torture. And it was very, very interesting to see how this distinct system worked and how you have to work within that system. Okay, and finally, the conclusions and recommendations is something we have to do, I think, near the end of the session, and we have some time afterwards to draft them. But this was especially challenging for me. Jillian and I researched China, for example. And we had a whole lot of research to do, and the committee session was kind of contentious. And in the conclusions and recommendations, you know, we draft them, the committee then writes their own, but I think our drafts are taken into account. The kind of language that's used and this kind of line to walk between diplomacy to get China in this case, to come back again, and yet honesty to express the committee's views about their practices, it was a very interesting line to have to walk. And also, it really made you pay a lot of attention during the session and do your research extremely well. Oh yeah, China specifically, like I said, it was a contentious session. They basically contended that a lot of the questions that the committee members had asked were based on improper research or, you know, false reports. And so the kind of the perspective of the committee and the perspective of the state party, they brought a huge delegation, by the way, maybe like 30 or 40 people, were very kind of at odds. And so we drafted the conclusions and the recommendations, the committee published the version, and afterwards, China actually made a statement to the press about how wrong the committee was, and how, you know, how political the statements were, and how it was based on, you know, falsified information. And while this, I mean, this is my own personal feelings, while it seemed like China was putting the committee down, and they were, it actually felt like a victory. Like, it felt like the committee had done something that had made China sit back and take notice. And I felt like that was a really important thing to do. I mean, to get China to come to the table and say something was important. To watch them kind of say that we weren't telling the truth was difficult, but then to kind of get them to react felt pretty good. And I think that's all that we have to say. Oh yeah, just one more thing. We'd all like to express our extreme gratitude for this opportunity. It was really amazing. We encourage everyone to apply. If you see us in the halls and you want to ask these questions, I'm speaking for everyone, I guess. Stop us.
Does anyone have any quick questions at the moment?
Two very practical questions. First of all, what kind of qualifications are you looking for when you are actually applying for this? And second of all, are there any financial commitments involved?
From our side. Well, the application fee is $500. No. The law school pays for the whole thing. And you can mention whatever the money is.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the financial commitments, it's just you take the seminar for credit. So that is the charge. But as Dean Gosman mentioned, your costs involved in traveling to Geneva and whatnot are fully covered by the law school. In terms of qualifications, we're looking for students who have demonstrated a sustained commitment to human rights. And for students particularly who are going to use this as they pursue their careers in human rights, so that it's not just a one, an isolated incident. And in addition to that, we're looking for students who have solid academic standing.
Well, also, many of you go, on February 23rd, we're having a very special conference here, the International Conference on the Prevention of Torture and Other Treatment. And really, we have invited the two schools in this field. We're going to have Mark Thompson, Secretary General of the Association for the Prevention of Torture, which is an important NGO in that Manfred Novak, which is the Rapporteur of Torture of the United Nations. Ambassador Luis Gallegos, which is a member of the Committee Against Torture, Matt Poller, Legal Advisor, Amnesty International, Stephen Watt, Senior Attorney, ACLU, Human Rights Program, James Ross, Legal and Policy Director of Human Rights Watch, Eugene Fidel, President of the National Institute of Military Justice, David Danzig, Public Program Department and Pre-Time Torture Project Director, Human Rights First, Santiago Cantón, Executive Secretary, Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, Dean Malcolm Evans, Bristol University Law Faculty, and Viviana Christisevich, Executive Director of the Center for Justice and International Law, Support Plus Faculty of the Washington College of Law. Nora Speas from Norway, which is Vice Chair of the United Nations Committee Against Torture. So we're going to have the who is who here, the 23rd of February. We invited also Eric Holder, the new Attorney General, but he's very busy. That's right, you know, totally understand. We'll see whether we invite, a member of Congress, also the new person in the State Department in charge of humanitarian law, will be available. We will invite her again. So I think if you want to make contacts from there, take a look at things, I think it's a tremendous opportunity. So that's the pitch I want to make. Any other questions?
Jennifer, you mentioned that there's a requirement of submitting a cover letter and the CV. Is there anything subsequent to that in the application process, or is that?
No, that's really it. I think the one thing I should add, however, is if you could include maybe two or three references, at least one that is a WCL professor, that would be very helpful.
I would just add, in response to both of those questions, that while all of the students this year certainly have a commitment to human rights, we're a very broad group and have come from very broad backgrounds and experiences, and so they're not looking for one goal. They're not looking for, you have to have done X, Y, and Z. I mean, we're very different. We have different interests and it made for a very good group.
Hi, my question is more about the actual experience at the committee meetings. I've worked for several years with an NGO where I participated in submissions for the UPR process. And so it sounds similar to like what you guys were doing in terms of research and consolidating and reporting. And I'm envious of the fact that you're able to participate in these sessions and actually see and hear the responses from the various nation representatives, because certainly I've never had that opportunity, but I always read the responses and they are usually, like you said, very defensive and denying the accusations. And especially the last presenter, you mentioned that it was unique in that it was not an adversarial mode, but yet it was distinct from the, you said, traditional United States model, and yet it was very adversarial. I'm just wondering how.
Well, it was definitely adversarial in terms of people got kind of heated and had kind of conflicting point of views. It wasn't adversarial in terms that we kind of think of fair trial norms being adversarial, at least in this country, in terms of you get to cross-examine, there's an independent decision maker. So it was definitely, it was distinct from adversarial, especially in that, like Solomon said, and as you know from the UPR system, this country's ratify, they report, and then every 4 years they're supposed to come back. And so, for China specifically, the committee could have burnt its bridges by saying certain things, and China wouldn't have come back. And so I believe that desire to get China back to the table 4 years from then influences how people ask questions and how the recommendations were written. So there's this idea that this is kind of a long-term partnership rather than the country comes to the committee and the committee gives judgment, basically.
A quick related question to the panel with all of your experiences. Were there cases, because in most of my experiences they've been extremely adversarial responses, were there cases where you confronted a country or had a dialogue with a country in which they said this, they recognized and admitted to the problem and committed to addressing it, or was it always, find it was always rejectionist?
I thought we saw a lot of the countries were there because they they're looking to improve the situation in their own country, and they're there because they want to take part in the conversation with the committee. Particularly Kenya, I thought, was really, they were admitting to a lot of fault in their system. They said that this is, for us, is a process, and we're looking to improve, and they were looking for recommendations from the committee members to make those improvements. And so certainly it's a different tone, I think, than other countries, including ours, you know, take. And so it definitely was exciting to hear that.
So it's really set up in a way where the committee members are all experts in human rights. And so these countries are coming to these committee members a lot of times and saying, you know, okay, we have these problems, what do you recommend, what should we be doing, you know, these are the difficulties that we have. They're often political as well. So it is a dialogue, and it's, you know, so I think in that way there were a lot of countries that were there to get help from experts from around the world.
There are cases also that are mentioned, a specific situation, Miss X, Mr. X, you know, we got, was detained, disappeared, or the lawyers can visit her or him, and so forth and so on. And then, you know, it's a way for the committee members to raise a very also complete situation. In addition, the colleagues here have talked about the reporting system. The committee structure also has is competent to receive petitions of individuals who claim that the rights under the treaty have been violated, only concerning countries that have made an express declaration of acceptance of the committee's jurisdiction for that purpose. And, you know, we didn't talk about this, but we distributed against signing with the duty of confidentiality some of the petitions where the committee, you know, acts in a semi-judicial function, and everything is in writing. There is a presentation by the petitioner in writing, a response by the state, usually again a presentation by the government, and the petitioner at the government. Then the committee adopts a final decision. There is a draft prepared by the secretariat, and I distributed drafts to the some of you, but everyone got a draft. Right? Everyone got a draft. And for comment and to know, and then also the possibility to sit down during discussions, I think, all concrete petitions, which is a very unique thing. 2 years ago, we brought some students also, and the other members of the committee complained that that was not possible. But now I am the committee chair, so you have to complain. That gives a possibility to play a little bit and do transactions. So, and I think the mistake we did the first year is that we brought six people, and then it was too much. Now it was about two, three maximum. So that was better. But that, I think, also is a very unique possibility. Usually the cases concern violations of Article 3. That means sending someone to a country where he or she runs a serious risk of torture. But usually, the countries that have ratified and declared their acceptance of this competent do not torture themselves. Usually, sometimes they torture also. So that's the answer. Well, I think it's 1:15. Thank you for your interest, and thank you for your